From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Welcome to the Friday edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships for Family Research Council. And 95,000 non-citizens have just been registered to vote, 58,000 of which have voted since 1996 and very possibly in the last election. I'll talk with Professor Margot Cleveland of the University of Notre Dame, who wrote a fascinating piece for The Federalist and will join me to discuss what it means for the 2020 elections. Then at 22 past the hour, we celebrate that Asia Bibi, the Pakistani Christian woman, unfairly imprisoned for 8 years on death row over trumped-up blasphemy charges, has made it safely to Canada. Last October, the Pakistani Supreme Court acquitted her, which they just recently upheld despite virulent threats from Islamic extremists in Muslim-majority nation of Pakistan. And my guest is Ismail Royer, the director of the Islam and Religious Freedom Action Team at the Religious Freedom Institute. In our third block, first it was New York, then it was Virginia, and we'll learn about another extreme abortion bill set to become law in Vermont. I will talk to their executive right to life director, Mary Hahn Beerworth, about how radical the Green Mountain State Legislature has become. She's asserted that Planned Parenthood is the fourth branch of Vermont government, and it's part of a disturbing trend among the states attempting to codify Roe v. Wade now that Trump has placed two conservative constitutionalists on the Supreme Court. And on our last block together, conservatives and liberals can actually agree on something. And no, I am not making that up. Transgender ideology is actually obliterating what it means to be a man and a woman. I'll get a chance to talk to Kathy Roos, Senior Fellow and Director of Human Dignity for the Family Research Council, who attended a fascinating panel discussion held at the Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank here in D.C., that featured lesbians and feminists, yes, on a conservative dais, with intriguing stories to tell. All this is on tap today for Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. Check out resources and the podcast, in addition to lots more information at tonyperkins.com. You can follow Tony on Twitter at tperkins and me at Sarah P. Perry. And as always, a reminder for the House and Senate switch lines, 202-224-3121 is your House number, 202-225-3121, your Senate number. Before we jump into our first segment, it does bear noting that Ralph Northam, who's fresh off the heels of defending his infanticide comments, was just recently addressed in the Virginia Pilot as appearing in a yearbook page that seemed to promote him and show him in blackface or a KKK hood. More on that later. My first guest today is Margot Cleveland. Margot is a senior contributor to The Federalist and has written also for The Washington Examiner, Town Hall, National Review, Wall Street Journal, and USA Today. She's an attorney and a graduate of Notre Dame Law School, where she earned the Hoynes Prize, which is the law school's highest honor. She has served for 25 years as a permanent law clerk for federal appellate judge on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals and is former full-time faculty at University of Notre Dame. She frequently writes on cultural issues related to parenting and special needs children, an issue that's close to my heart. And she's going to join us to talk a little bit today about what we've recently discovered in terms of elections. So, Margot, your piece in The Federalist debuted on January 28th, and within 2 days, we were learning that a similar situation had happened in Pennsylvania. So can you set up exactly what we discovered about elections in the state of Texas pursuant to your piece?
Sure. So in Texas, the people charged with overseeing the voter rolls have to clean the rolls up, and the Texas Secretary of State did a review of the current rolls along with the Department of Public Safety. And what they discovered was that people who applied to get a driver's license and used a green card to prove that they were legally present in the United States We're also on voting rolls, which is a big problem because in Texas, you can get a driver's license as a non-citizen, but you cannot vote if you are not a citizen. So what they did is they were trying to come up with a procedure that they could use to keep the rolls current. And in this process, they discovered that there were nearly 100,000 people registered to vote who, when they had gone to get their driver's license, showed that they were non-citizens with documentation, such as a green card. And of those, they had nearly 58,000 who it showed that they had voted in an election. So this is a huge problem in Texas, and as you mentioned, then we see something similar in Pennsylvania.
In Pennsylvania, there were approximately 11,000 non-citizens who the state confirmed are registered to vote, even though they were not eligible to do so. And this was sort of a belated acknowledgement of the administration of Governor Tom Wolf. So we're seeing what looks to be a bit of a national trend. Do you think that's an accurate representation?
Well, I to say it's a national trend, I'd want to see what more states are doing. But I can see this being something that is very feasible to expect in every state now that we have voter motor and the law that when you get a driver's license, you can also register to vote. Because some states, you can get a driver's license without even showing you're legally present in the state, such as in California. But even in the states where you have the right to get a driver's license only if you're legally present, you can be also at that time signing up to vote. Now, whether this is a matter of confusion that they think, oh, I'm legally present, I can vote, or it's a matter of intentional fraud, it doesn't matter. It is a crime federally, and it is causing people who are legitimate voters, citizens, to be disenfranchised.
Now, I find that word, disenfranchisement, interesting because I'm going to play devil's advocate.
Sure.
One of the spokespeople from the League of United Latin American Citizens stated very firmly that the disenfranchisement of these 95,000 American citizens, now, interestingly, he calls them American citizens, even though we know they were not, according to records, he used that as his primary argument to essentially replicate the same commentary from the New York Times, which was you are locking people out of the voting process and you are disallowing them from one of the inherent rights that being an American gives them. How do you answer a criticism like that?
Absolutely wrong. And in fact, it shows that they don't care about voter suppression because every time a non-citizen votes, they are suppressing the vote of a citizen. If I go vote and a non-citizen votes, they cancel out my vote. This is not a situation where it's making it harder to vote. We are talking solely about assuring that only citizens are voting. And in this case, they're not just saying, oh, I think that these people might not be citizens. These are people who presented to get a driver's license evidence, a green card, that by definition means they are not citizens. Additionally, if there are mistakes, I think the New York Times said, oh, well, you know, bureaucracies, they have mistakes. Well, it's nice that they finally recognize that, and we don't want the government doing everything. But beside that point, it doesn't, if there's a mistake, what happens is a letter is sent, and it says you have 30 days to show that this is a mistake. There is no chance of disenfranchisement of people who are citizens. One, it's a very clear methodology based on evidence presented. And two, it's an easy way to say, no, you made a mistake. On the other hand, when you ignore people who are not citizens voting, you are suppressing the votes of 58,000 American citizens, and that is wrong.
Well, let's talk about numbers for a second. So we're looking at approximately 11,000 in Pennsylvania and 95,000 in Texas. And those are numbers by national standards that don't seem to be too terribly compelling. And it was, in fact, the New York Times' argument that if all of those individuals had voted, it would only amount to approximately 0.69%, not even a full percent. So when you're looking at the aggregate values, it doesn't seem like a lot of voters, but we know that there is an argument against that. And you wrote about that particular situation in your piece at the Federalist.
Right. And as I said, after I quoted their 0.69%, that, you know, it's not going to change. And I say, well, that's one way to put it. If you want to obscure the significance of the 58,000 fraudulent votes, all you have to do is remember why George W. Bush was president and not Al Gore. In Florida, it was a mere 537 votes. It is absolutely ridiculous to try to put it down to a percentage of 0.69, because one vote can matter, 537 votes can matter, 58,000 votes can matter. And we're not just talking about Texas. We're not talking about Pennsylvania. It can matter for the presidency of the United States. It can matter for who holds the Senate. It can matter for who holds the House. It has huge significances, widespread throughout the country. And one of the problems is leaving it to the states to do, because you will have states that don't care. And that's where I say, look, enough is enough. If the states aren't going to clean this up, we need the feds to go and take a look at who has green cards and make sure those individuals are not on the voting rolls. And if they are, get them off.
So that was my next question, is what we do when we are faced with not only increasing incidents of what appears to be voter fraud, whether it was, as you said, mistake or otherwise. We have sort of the pervasive sense that this might just be the tip of the iceberg. And in fact, some of the conservative watchdog groups in Washington, Judicial Watch among them, our friends there have said that it shows the urgent need for citizenship verification for voting. So here we are, unbelievably, on the tip of the 2020 election season, and we already have a crowded Democratic field. So in these next 90 seconds, what do we do going forward as we approach the next series of elections?
Sure. So the question about, is it time? Are we able to get citizenship as a proof of citizenship to vote? I think that is a harder goal to accomplish in the short term, but there's absolutely no reason that President Trump cannot direct the Attorney General to work with the other agencies to check and see that non-citizens, individuals who have current green cards, are not in the voting rolls. That is something that could be done easily in 6 months.
So as we move forward from this point, it might also benefit us to activate that electorate. It not only shows the importance of verification, but also the importance of activating the individuals who may have sat back during the midterms and realized that, well, we have who we want in the Senate, we have who we want in our state legislatures, we have who we want in the White House, but there might be something to making sure that you go out and exercise the right that someone will take from you if you don't.
Absolutely.
My guest today has been Margot Cleveland. She is an attorney. She is with the University of Notre Dame, and we will have her on again soon. Thanks so much for being with us. We'll be right back on Washington Watch.
Myth and folklore have influenced our civilization for centuries. Some of these myths can be wondrous tales of fantasy that inspire us from childhood, such as unicorns and the ever-beloved elf on a shelf. Others, however, can be detrimental to our well-being, from the Loch Ness Monster to big tax refunds. Today, the myths surrounding abortion have become part of such vexations that plague our society. Since 1973, these abortion myths have grown a substantial foothold in developing a climate of fear, misinformation, and a culture of death in the United States. In FRC's new analysis, learn whether most Americans support abortion on demand, and if a fetus does in fact feel pain in the womb. Join us as we debunk these myths and find the truth to secure a future for the culture of life. visit frc.org/myths.
Your email inbox is probably filled with a lot of free stuff these days. Free is good, but most of our email ends up being free spam. If you want a healthier diet in your inbox, add Tony Perkins' Washington Update newsletter to your email menu. This daily update from Family Research Council is our flagship publication, an update with the latest pro-family take on Washington's hottest issues. The update goes beyond the headlines and examines what is really going on in our culture and politics from a biblical perspective. Are evangelicals showing up at the polls? Are faith-based adoption providers persecuting same-sex couples? The left and the media love to answer these questions for you. Let FRC remove the spin and give you real answers with the Washington Update. To subscribe to this free daily newsletter and to subscribe to other free resources, go to frc.org/connect. That's frc.org/connect.
The world on our horizon isn't like the days I knew. Gone are the days of writing with fresh ink on thick paper and the swift crack of a letter opener. Homemade meals now replaced by fancy robots trying to figure out how often I buy organic goji berries. I don't even know what a goji berry is. My church started offering free Wi-Fi and changed their name from First Baptist to Radiant Water Life something or other. They even started posting video sermons recorded on wood pallet backgrounds that sync directly to a Dropbox that I have yet to locate. Thankfully, there's a silver lining to all this newfangled technology. Family Research Council's Stand Firm app. Put down your quill and contact your legislators directly from your smartphone or tablet. Share legislative alerts with your contacts and connect with like-minded Christians about the latest current events. Read the Washington Update and listen to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. This thing's got it all, buddy boy. Keep your cool and help secure our future at frc.org/app.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships, sitting in for Tony Perkins here today. Asia Bibi, the Christian mother of five who spent 8 years on death row in Pakistan on trumped-up blasphemy charges, has apparently, according to her attorney, arrived safely in Canada with her husband. The Pakistani Supreme Court recently upheld her previous acquittal after calls by an extremist group to vacate the decision. So our guest now will help me put it all into perspective. Ismail Royer is director of the Islam and Religious Freedom Action Team at the Religious Freedom Institute, a nonprofit based in Washington, D.C. Since converting to Islam in 1992, he has studied religious sciences with traditional Islamic scholars and spent over a decade working at nonprofit Islamic organizations. His writing has appeared in multiple publications such as the Washington Post, the Journal of Religion and Society, and Detroit Free Press. Ismail, welcome to Washington Watch.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
You're very welcome. Ismail, because of security concerns, there are conflicting reports about whether or not Asia Bibi has actually made it safely to Canada. Was there, you believe, reason to believe she might still be in Pakistan, or do you think it's a safe assumption that she is now in Canada and out of harm's way?
I have heard from a former Canadian ambassador, who I think wouldn't want me to name him, that she is actually still in Pakistan, but that she is on her way to Canada, and Canada's accepted her, and that she'll be there soon. That's what I've heard.
So we're going to talk a little bit about the dramatic unrest in Pakistan over the Supreme Court's acquittal of Asia Bibi. What I'd like our listeners to figure out and to explore is why a Muslim majority nation expects Christians not to remain true to their religious convictions and everyday conversation, even though Islam itself requires the same thing. What is the unrest, the discrepancy between those two points of view?
Well, first I'll say that it's a complicated situation in Pakistan, and it's important to note that while we do have problems with blasphemy laws, not only legal regimes, but also vigilante mobs in some areas of the Muslim world, such as Indonesia or Egypt, and so on. Pakistan is unique because of the severity of the problem. So one has to understand and ask, why does Pakistan have this uniquely severe problem with respect to persecution of Christian, the Christian minority? And I think that there are a number of things to look at. First of all, it's that these mobs that we see that are generated in Pakistan are often due to the fact that these blasphemy allegations, they strike at a very emotional chord in a sect of Pakistanis called the Brahmanis. And the Brahmanis are a Sufi sect that are heterodox. They have a they love the Prophet Muhammad so much that they almost worship him. And for that reason, they're considered somewhat outside the fold of mainstream Islam. And but they make up a very large percentage of the population of Pakistan. And their love for the Prophet is so intense and so, frankly, extreme that they become very fanatical and agitated whenever there are any allegations of blasphemy. And what happens is that demagogues and politicians and so on can, if they want to generate huge mobs in the street, simply just float these allegations of blasphemy. And then, of course, Christians, being a minority, are often scapegoated for that reason. So I think that this is one of the reasons for this. And it's not really, in the case of Pakistan, it's actually not the so-called Wahhabis and so on and that are behind us, but frankly, it's these extreme Sufis. And so there's that. Also, we have the fact that there are these blasphemy laws in Pakistan, which were passed by a military government in the 80s that was trying to score legitimacy with the population of Pakistan after a military coup that it carried out. And so this military government implemented this blasphemy law as a means of appeasing these sort of like village folk Muslims. And what happened is that this law became a means and a tool of persecution of Christians. If you look at the people who are prosecuted under this law, it winds up being almost 50% are not Muslims. And a very large number of that are Christians. One other thing that I would point out as well is that Christians in Pakistan tend to have been descended from the so-called untouchables under the Hindu caste system or the Dalits. And Pakistani Muslims have inherited, unfortunately, they have inherited this sense that these descendants of the Dalits are unclean. So that's what happened with the case of Asia Bibi, where, you know, this whole argument started where she supposedly drank some water that from a cup that was used by Muslims, and there you see this sort of sense of uncleanliness of the descendants from the Dalits now assuming a new form, but with an Islamic, so-called Islamic sort of patina over it.
We've got about 60 seconds left. There are a number of ongoing cases involving Christians accused of blasphemy. Because of this acquittal, do we have reason to hope that these individuals might also be acquitted?
I do think that this is a signal from the Pakistani courts that they are that their tolerance of this sort of thing is coming to an end. The good thing is that the courts in Pakistan are made up tend to be made up by people of a much higher caliber of understanding. I think that this signals that they're not going to continue to tolerate this sort of persecution, at least under the law. And what we hope for. Yes.
I've got to let you go. I wish we could talk more about this, but I have been it's been my great pleasure to talk to you today. You're listening to Washington Watch, and right after this break, we're going to talk about what we originally thought was a tough abortion law and then hear about one even tougher. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships. I'm in for Tony Perkins today on Washington Watch. Thank you.
Myth and folklore have influenced our civilization for centuries. Some of these myths can be wondrous tales of fantasy that inspire us from childhood, such as unicorns and the ever-beloved elf on a shelf. Others, however, can be detrimental to our well-being, from the Loch Ness Monster to big tax refunds. Today, the myths surrounding abortion have become part of such vexations that plague our society. Since 1973, these abortion myths have grown a substantial foothold in developing a climate of fear, misinformation, and a culture of death in the United States. In FRC's new analysis, learn whether most Americans support abortion on demand, and if a fetus does in fact feel pain in the womb. Join us as we debunk these myths and find the truth to secure a future for the culture of life. Visit frc.org/myths.
Your email inbox is probably filled with a lot of free stuff these days. Free is good, but most of our email ends up being free spam. If you want a healthier diet in your inbox, add Tony Perkins' Washington Update newsletter to your email menu. This daily update from Family Research Council is our flagship publication, an update with the latest pro-family take on Washington's hottest issues. The update goes beyond the headlines and examines what is really going on in our culture and politics from a biblical perspective. Are evangelicals showing up at the polls? Are faith-based adoption providers persecuting same-sex couples? The left and the media love to answer these questions for you. Let FRC remove the spin and give you real answers with the Washington Update. To subscribe to this free daily newsletter and to subscribe to other free resources, go to frc.org/connect. That's frc.org/connect.
The Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I'm Sarah Perry. In this segment, we'll be talking state pro-life laws. And before we get into that, visit VirginiaPilotOnline.com because you will see, breaking just today, an article about Ralph Northam, the governor of Virginia's yearbook page from high school, showing men in blackface and a KKK robe. Now, I will not draw any conclusions. You are welcome to draw your own, but it certainly does confound the populace when you realize that an individual making comments associated with infanticide was featured in his yearbook in very possibly white robes or blackface. Look that up, listeners. Today, not to be outdone by New York's recently enacted law to permit abortions at virtually any point in pregnancy, and after the comments made on the Virginia bill, Vermont has joined the fight, and they've introduced an abortion protection law that may in some ways be even more extreme. To give us the full scoop, I'm going to talk now with a woman at the center of the pro-life fight to protect preborn babies. I'm joined today by Mary Hahn Beerworth, executive director and lobbyist for Vermont's Rights to Life. Mary, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you for having me, Sarah.
So, Mary, we're faced with quite an interesting bill. More than 90 members of the Vermont State House are co-sponsoring legislation to codify a fundamental right to abortion. So they're sort of elevating what Roe v. Wade decided back in 73 and actually taking it to sort of new protected extremes. So what we're talking about right now, according to Maggie Gallagher of Planned Parenthood, we have to pass the House Abortion Bills Right, the Abortion Rights Bill, and the Senate Equal Rights Constitutional Amendment to ensure that reproductive rights are protected in Vermont. So, Mary, you've described very brightly, I think, Planned Parenthood is the fourth branch of government in Vermont. So how entrenched are they, and how much do you believe they had to do with this proposed legislation?
Oh, I believe they have everything to do with it, Sarah. Planned Parenthood is a force to be reckoned with in the state. They have 12 clinics in the tiny little state of Vermont with a population of just over 600,000. Mm. Some of those are just feeder clinics, but at least three large clinics will make sure you can get a surgical abortion, and others make sure you can have a chemical abortion. And let me just compare that to New Hampshire, which has a population of 1.5 million and just five Planned Parenthood clinics.
They get a tremendous
amount of federal and state dollars. That builds the base upon which they can run their business. And then they use a lot of their private fundraising ability to make big donations at election time. So we have a legislature that's beholden to them. They are working to make sure Planned Parenthood is happy with them. And when you said 91 co-sponsors, we've shaken off a couple of those who have said, wow, I was lied to. And they, now that they understand the bill, they've taken their names off. But that's 91 out of 150 legislators. So
wow.
This thing is on a fast track to pass. The legislation is alarming. We have had expert testimony saying it opens babies up to experimentation, to harvesting of organs, because this is one line. A fertilized egg, embryo, or fetus shall not have independent rights under Vermont law. So that's stripping any potential possibility to protect an unborn child. And that kind of testimony is not disturbing those listening to it at this point, I'm sad to say.
So once, let's say, if we fail in our efforts to make sure that we block the door in this legislation, if it makes it to Governor Scott's desk, what are the possibilities that he'll veto horrific legislation like this?
I'm not sure what Governor Scott will do. He'll be hamstrung in any case, because if he can't reach 50 no's on this bill out of in the House, then if he vetoes it, it will simply be overridden. But I have worse news, because there's also a Senate bill. So once this bill leaves the House and goes over to the Senate side, there is this language: a health care provider performing or assisting with a legal abortion procedure shall not be subject to any civil, criminal, or administrative liability or penalty.
Oh, wow.
Any. So they won't need malpractice insurance to do abortions, and we've actually will have sent up a red flag saying, you know, Kermit Gosnell types can flourish here in Vermont. And we are trying to make an impression, but we are not being listened to at this point.
That actually is probably the most terrifying aspect of all of this, is that everything that Kermit Gosnell was convicted of would now be made legal under Vermont law. So
that's correct.
What are the opportunities for the listeners that we have and the good folks in the state of Vermont to fight back against something like this? What are your suggestions to those listening?
Well, I would really suggest prayer for people, because this is a state that is deeply entrenched. It began with a eugenics movement that leagued up with Planned Parenthood. So it runs very deep. It's about 100 years old of a disdain and disregard for human life. And so our lawmakers resent out-of-state interference. They want to hear from Vermonters. So please, if you know Vermonters, please have them call their legislators. And from out-of-state, I'm not sure how you can help besides pray for us and send us your good wishes and goodwill, and ask people to call who live in Vermont.
How do people get a hold of Vermont Right to Life if they want to support your efforts, Mary?
Oh, check us out online. We are at www.vrlc.net, and you can reach us at vrlc@vrlc.net.
You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here at FRC. Coming up next, conservatives and liberals can't agree on transgender ideology, but just what will they have to say? I'll talk to Kathy Roos next.
The world on our horizon isn't like the days I knew. Gone are the days of writing with fresh ink on thick paper and the swift crack of a letter opener. Homemade meals now replaced by fancy robots trying to figure out how often I buy organic goji berries. I don't even know what a goji berry is. My church started offering free Wi-Fi and changed their name from First Baptist to Radiant Water Life something or other. They even started posting video sermons recorded on wood pallet backgrounds that sync directly to a Dropbox that I have yet to locate. Thankfully, there's a silver lining to all this newfangled technology. Family Research Council's Stand Firm app. Put down your quill and contact your legislators directly from your smartphone or tablet. Share legislative alerts with your contacts and connect with like-minded Christians about the latest current events. Read the Washington Update and listen to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. This thing's got it all, buddy boy. Keep your cool and help secure our future at frc.org/app.
Your email inbox is probably filled with a lot of free stuff these days. Free is good, but most of our email ends up being free spam. If you want a healthier diet in your inbox, add Tony Perkins' Washington Update newsletter to your email menu. This daily update from Family Research Council is our flagship publication, an update with the latest pro-family take on Washington's hottest issues. The update goes beyond the headlines and examines what is really going on in our culture and politics from a biblical perspective. Are evangelicals showing up at the polls? Are faith-based adoption providers persecuting same-sex couples? The left and the media love to answer these questions for you. Let FRC remove the spin and give you real answers with the Washington Update. To subscribe to this free daily newsletter and to subscribe to other free resources, go to frc.org/connect. That's frc.org/connect.
Myth and folklore have influenced our civilization for centuries. Some of these myths can be wondrous tales of fantasy, from unicorns to the ever-beloved elf on a shelf. Others, however, can be detrimental to our well-being. Today, the myths surrounding abortion have become part of such vexations that plague our society. In FRC's analysis, 10 Myths on Abortion, join us as we debunk these myths and find the truth to secure a future for the culture of life. Visit frc.org/myths.
Your email inbox is probably filled with a lot of free stuff these days. Free is good, but most of our email ends up being free spam. If you want a healthier diet in your inbox, add Tony Perkins' Washington Update newsletter to your email menu. The update goes beyond the headlines and examines what is really going on in our culture and politics from a biblical perspective. To subscribe to this free daily newsletter and to subscribe to our other free resources, go to frc.org/connect.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry sitting in for Tony Perkins today. Liberals and conservatives are agreeing on a few things, and most recently, it's that they both believe blind loyalty to the politically correct notion about transgenderism is a terrible idea. The Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank here in D.C., held a panel discussion recently with several liberals, including a few feminists and lesbians, who can't believe how they have been pushed out of the marketplace by the left's new fascination with transgenderism. Kathy Roos is our senior fellow and director of human dignity here at FRC, was there, heard it all in person, and joins me now. Kathy, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you, Sarah. Thanks for having me and covering this topic.
Kathy, this is certainly quite a development. And in fact, the reason for the panel itself was rather strange in that the lefts were really giving no quarter in terms of housing a similar discussion on the issue. So what is it about this notion of transgender activism that is disenfranchising even individuals who are purportedly of the left political leaning sect?
Well, it's so interesting to see this rift between the LGB group and the T. And what lesbians, bisexuals, and homosexuals, who were all present on this panel, their beef against the transgender movement is that it is basically requiring the erasure of recognition of sex. And when women think about that, that means that all of the safe spaces that women need in the world, bathrooms, showers, locker rooms, separated prisons, for instance, sports, all of those things are threatened by the radical transgender ideology, which says that it is wrong to acknowledge any difference, any bodily differences even between men and women. Even the idea that you're recognizing a biological sex, that there are biological men and biological women, is offensive to the transgender movement. And these brave leftists went into the Heritage Foundation, which is not a place where they would normally maybe want to go because it's, you know, Heritage is conservative. These were very progressive left liberal people, but they were saying that we agree with you conservatives that trying to replace sex with gender identity will harm all people, especially women and girls, but also men.
So the notion of inclusivity and tolerance has really sort of been turned on its head, as is evidenced by this panel. And we have two clips. The first one is Jennifer Chavez, who is with the Women's Liberation Front. And she shared one of the many real life stories about a parent who experienced a child who believed that a gender transition was required.
I was shocked when my 13-year-old daughter told me that she was really my transgender son. She had no masculine interest and hated all sports. But as a smart, quirky teen on the autism spectrum, she had a long history of not fitting in with girls. Where did she get the idea she was transgender? From a school presentation, a school where over 5% of the entire student body called themselves trans or non-binary, where several students were already on hormones, and one had a mastectomy at the age of 16. In my daughter's world, real life and online, transgender identities are common and hormones and surgeries are no big deal. I took her to a gender clinician seeking expert guidance. Instead, he accepted her new identity and told me I must refer to my daughter with masculine pronouns, call her by a masculine name, and buy her a binder to flatten her breasts. No therapy, no consideration of the social factors that obviously affected her thinking. I was directed to put her on puberty-blocking drugs and was falsely assured that these drugs were well-studied and a perfectly safe way for her to explore gender.
Lesbian Julia Beck, who used to be on the Baltimore LGBTQ Commission but was fired from that commission, joined in with her story describing about how she felt politically homeless.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Julia Beck. I live in Baltimore City, and I am a lesbian. You might be thinking to yourself, why is a lesbian speaking of the Heritage Foundation? And I ask myself the same thing. But my answer is pretty simple. There is no place for me. I am politically homeless. So believe me when I say I am grateful for the opportunity to share my story. My story is as unbelievable and absurd as it is commonplace. I got kicked off of the Baltimore Mayor's LGBTQ Commission as the only lesbian simply for stating biological facts. After a months-long witch hunt, I was found guilty of violence. My crime? Using male pronouns to talk about a convicted male rapist who identifies as transgender and prefers female pronouns. It doesn't matter that he sexually assaulted two women in a women's prison after being transferred there on account of his gender identity. Oh no, it is far more criminal for me to call a male rapist he than it is for him to rape. The man who led my inquisition also identifies as transgender. He is the president of the Baltimore Transgender Alliance and claims to be a lesbian. I find that almost funny. Because everything he does makes life for women, girls, and lesbians worse.
So this panel discussion was purportedly to be about the Equality Act and Nancy Pelosi's new rallying cry. And really, there were some discussions about how this notion of transgender activism has locked out women, particularly these feminists and these lesbians who have set their identities upon the fact that their sex is immutable and cannot be changed. It is not some social fad to be changed with the whims of science. But I am, as I know you are, concerned with the import on these prepubescent children, because these are young women and young men who are going to extremes in the medical world to try to satisfy what is in large part a passing fancy that will dissipate with puberty. So what are we looking at medically in terms of what these teens and preteens are willing to go to because of this societal contagion?
Right, and it is a social contagion, just like anorexia and bulimia of 30 years ago was so devastating to the whole population of young women. And we're seeing, yes, the increasing number of adolescent, largely girls, all of a sudden announcing they're in the wrong bodies, and they're convincing their parents to take them to these gender clinics. And more often than not, the stories are staggering. The gender clinicians don't bother exploring any other possible causes of their mental distress. They don't pursue previous trauma. They don't pursue anything else, but they push the girls and their parents down the path of so-called transitioning, which begins with puberty blockers, and then is followed by strong hormones, opposite sex hormones, and then that is often followed by mutilating surgery. Before you even get to the surgery part, you render these young women infertile for life. It's irreversible. Mm. And if it's boys you're pushing down this path, you are stunting their, well, girls too, but boys, you stunt their growth that they cannot get back if they later realize that this was a horrible experiment and a mistake. So you're doing permanent damage to young bodies and minds, and it's like an experiment on kids. My husband calls it the trans cult, and it is like a cult. Mm. And they're conducting experiments on other people's kids, and they are doing violence not only to children but to free speech. We're not allowed, you know, if using the wrong pronoun is equivalent to violence, then they really are revealing themselves to be sort of the totalitarian, brutal movement that all the people on this panel know them to be, and conservatives are now learning them to be.
So we have a situation before us that medical science, medical expertise, which heretofore would have been considered absolutely anathema to question because we understood the XX, XY differentiation, and we understood the nature of biology, and these were basic, simplistic concepts. To what do we owe this fanatical rise of transgender activism? There is something, I believe, particularly pervasive in the teenage environment with these preteens and these teens who are subject to such strong peer influences, such strong media influences. But why do we see the medical profession itself willing to shuck hundreds of years of understood medical history just to be able to activate or to satisfy a very minute portion of the population? Why the surge?
Right. You know, I don't know a good answer to why. I don't know a good theory to why, but I do want to put a note of caution there that doctors will tell you that these medical associations, you know, they don't survey their members and say, okay, all of you 50,000 members of the American Medical Association, let's vote on whether we want to take a new position that biological sex is meaningless. They don't do that. These professional associations are run by small bodies of bureaucrats, committees, and these committees will make these kinds of decisions. Same thing with, you know, we see this everywhere. The American Library Association is notoriously hard left, mm-hmm. but your average librarian is just, you know, a sweet, common sense person who doesn't go along with these radical things. So just keep in mind that most of the medical profession has not gone down this road. Unfortunately, the people in positions of power in a lot of these professional medical associations are pushing the name of the organization, at least, down this path. So we do see medical organizations that are rejecting this and calling it child abuse. The American College of Pediatrics says this is institutionalized child abuse on a wide scale, and they're not afraid to say it. And there are other medical associations that will, you know, that agree and that still understand and are willing to profess the truth about the human body and so forth. So, but it is a rush to insanity, really, for the medical profession to pretend. Look, doctors will say, the ones that are still telling the truth about the human person, about the human body, they will say there are many reasons why we must distinguish male bodies from female bodies. I mean, dosages, diagnoses. I mean, the prospect is really dangerous if you take it to its logical end that we are now no longer permitted to recognize differences between men and women in the medical profession. That's crazy. So, but this movement is not interested in being logical, or truthful, or fact-based, or science-based. It's a radical political movement, really. It's politicizing kids in public schools.
where they are most vulnerable and where they're away from their parents for 8 hours a day. You heard that. I'm glad you played that clip about the parent's story, who said, where did my child get this notion that she is in the wrong body at school, from a school-sponsored presentation? But why does this strange political movement have so much power? That's a very good question. People on the left raise questions about money, where the money is coming from for this movement. And they're right. You know, you always got to look at that. And of course, the media has not done their job to kind of trace the rabbit trails and find out where the money's coming to fund this very powerful movement. Evan, but all these institutions are just falling over like dominoes. You know, you may not use these pronouns. You must allow underage girls to have mastectomies. You know, little tiny children as young as 8 have to be put on puberty blockers. And by the way, it's just a complete lie to say that puberty blockers are to buy time so that children can figure out whether they're boys or girls. That's a complete lie, because every single time, I mean, there's no recorded instance yet where a child put on puberty blockers and then cross-sex ever goes in the other direction. That is essentially pushing them down the path to sex transition and a transgender identity. So it's just, so any parent that is listening who thinks, well, maybe I'm told that this is the kind thing to do, to just give my child some space and time to decide, reject that as the lie that it is. That is a lie. That will push the child toward a transgender identity and all of the horror that follows.
Well, and kids, preteens, teens, do often feel as though they are different, that they don't fit in. This is a common occurrence of adolescence. And I would add on to that by saying mental health is an unaddressed need of a lot of these kids in schools. And it needs to be addressed first, why there is dissonance, why there's cognitive dissonance, and there is a sense of dysphoria in one's own body. Address that need first before administering things like Lupron, before having mastectomy, before going through radical surgeries and hormone blockers that will have irreversible lifelong consequences. So we just talked a little bit about the possibility and opportunity of parents like you and me who are faced with this dilemma if they have a child that comes to them. Is it something that we simply pray about and get help about in these last couple of seconds we have left?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the best medical resource for parents, they're overwhelmed, but they will try to help, is the American College of Pediatricians. Not the APA, but the American College of Pediatricians. But yes, and we got to pray for these parents and these poor children. They really need prayer and support.
Kathy Roos has been my guest today. Kathy, always wonderful to talk to you. Thanks for your encouragement, for talking about a very important and necessary panel. Thank you, listeners, for joining us today. This is Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships, in for Tony Perkins here on Washington Watch. Go to tonyperkins.com for more information.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit tonyperkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.